Chapter 17. Of some dark menace from abroad. Then he reflected that he did not know her epistolary style, and that it might run to picturesque exaggeration. Women always exaggerated. And moreover, she was not wholly at her ease in English, which she often spoke, as if she were translating from the French. Amy Sousavad, put in that way, the opening sentence immediately suggested that she might merely have wanted to escape from a boring round of engagements, which was very likely true, for he judged her to be capricious, and easily wearied of the pleasure of the moment. It amused him to think of the van der Luydens having carried her off to Schuylkill on a second visit, and this time for an indefinite period. The doors of Schuylkill were rarely and grudgingly opened to visitors, and a chilly weekend was the most ever offered to the few thus privileged. But Archer had seen, on his last visit to Paris, the delicious play of Labich, La Voyage de M. Perrichin, and he remembered M. Perrichin's dogged and undiscouraged attachment to the young man whom he had pulled out of the glacier. The van der Luydens had rescued Madame Olenska from a doom almost as icy, and though there were many other reasons for being attracted to her, Archer knew that beneath them all lay the gentle and obstinate determination to go on rescuing her. He felt a distinct disappointment on learning that she was away, and almost immediately remembered that, only the day before, he had refused an invitation to spend the following Sunday with the Reggie Chiverses at their house on the Hudson, a few miles below Schuylkill. He had had his fill long ago of the noisy friendly parties at High Bank, with coasting, ice boating, sleighing, long tramps in the snow, and a general flavor of mild flirting and milder practical jokes. He had just received a box of new books from his London book-seller, and had preferred the prospect of a quiet Sunday at home with his spoils. But he now went into the club writing room, wrote a hurried telegram, and told the servant to send it immediately. He knew that Mrs. Reggie didn't object to her visitors suddenly changing their minds, and that there was always a room to spare in her elastic house. XV. Newland Archer arrived at the Chiverses on Friday evening, and on Saturday, went conscientiously through all the rites appertaining to a weekend at High Bank. In the morning he had a spin in the ice boat with his hostess, and a few of the hardier guests. In the afternoon he went over the farm with Reggie, and listened, in the elaborately appointed stables, to long and impressive disquisitions on the horse. After tea he talked in a corner of the firelit hall with a young lady who had professed herself broken-hearted when his engagement was announced, but was now eager to tell him of her own matrimonial hopes. And finally, about midnight, he assisted in putting a goldfish in one visitor's bed, dressed up a burglar in the bathroom of a nervous aunt, and saw in the small hours, by joining in a pillow fight that ranged from the nurseries to the basement. But on Sunday after luncheon he borrowed a cutter, and drove over to Schuylkill. People had always been told that the house at Schuylkill was an Italian villa. Those who had never been to Italy believed it, so did some who had. The house had been built by Mr. van der Luyden in his youth, on his return from the Grand Tour, and in anticipation of his approaching marriage with Miss Louisa Dagonet. It was a large square wooden structure, with tongued and grooved walls painted pale green and white, a Corinthian portico, and fluted pilasters between the windows. From the high ground on which it stood a series of terraces beordered by balustrades, and urns descended in the steel engraving style to a small irregular lake with an asphalt edge overhung by rare weeping conifers. To the right and left, the famous weedless lawn studded with piecemen trees, each of a different variety, rolled away to long ranges of grass crested with elaborate cast-iron ornaments. And below, in a hollow, lay the four-roomed stone house which the first patroon had built on the land, granted him in 1612. Against the uniform sheet of snow, and the grayish winter sky, the Italian villa loomed up rather grimly. Even in summer it kept its distance, and the boldest colonist had never ventured nearer than 30 feet from its awful front. Now, as Archer rang the bell, the long tinkle seemed to echo through a mausoleum, and the surprise of the butler who at length responded to the call was as great as though he had been summoned from his final sleep. Happily, Archer was of the family, and therefore, irregular though his arrival was, entitled to be informed that the Countess Olenska was out, having driven to afternoon service with Mrs. van der Luyden exactly 3/4 of an hour earlier. "Mr. van der Luyden," the butler continued, "is in, sir, but my impression is that he is either finishing his nap, or else reading yesterday's Evening Post. I heard him say, sir, on his return from church this morning, that he intended to look through the Evening Post after luncheon. If you like, sir, I might go to the library door and listen," but Archer, thanking him, said that he would go and meet the ladies, and the butler, obviously relieved, closed the door on him majestically. A groom took the cutter to the stables, and Archer struck through the park to the high road. The village of Skuytercliff was only a mile and a half away, but he knew that Mrs. van der Luyden never walked, and that he must keep to the road to meet the carriage. Presently, however, coming down a footpath that crossed the highway, he caught sight of a slight figure in a red cloak, with a big dog running ahead. He hurried forward, and Madame Olenska stopped short with a smile of welcome. "Ah, you've come," she said, and drew her hand from her muff. The red cloak made her look gay and vivid, like the Ellen Mingott of old days, and he laughed as he took her hand, and answered, "Came to see what you were running away from." Her face clouded over, but she answered, "H, well, you will see, presently." The answer puzzled him. "How do you mean, that you've been overtaken?" She shrugged her shoulders, with a little movement like Nastasia's, and rejoined in a lighter tone, "Shall we walk on? I'm so cold after the sermon. And what does it matter, now you're here to protect me?" The blood rose to his temples and he caught a fold of her cloak. "Len, what is it? You must tell me." "Oh, presently, let's run a race first. My feet are freezing to the ground," she cried, and gathering up the cloak she fled away across the snow, the dog leaping about her with challenging barks. For a moment Archer stood watching, his gaze delighted by the flash of the red meteor against the snow, then he started after her, and they met, panting and laughing, at a wicket that led into the park. She looked up at him and smiled. "Knew you'd come." "That shows you wanted me to," he returned, with a disproportionate joy in their nonsense. The white glitter of the trees filled the air with its own mysterious brightness, and as they walked on over the snow the ground seemed to sing under their feet. "Where did you come from?" Madame Olenska asked. He told her, and added, "Tea was because I got your note." After a pause she said, with a just perceptible chill in her voice, "I asked you to take care of me." "I didn't need any asking." "You mean I'm so evidently helpless and defenseless? What a poor thing you must all think me. But women here seem never to feel the need. Any more than the blessed in heaven." He lowered his voice to ask, "Hat sort of a need?" "Ah, don't ask me. I don't speak your language," she retorted petulantly. The answer smote him like a blow, and he stood still in the path, looking down at her. "What did I come for, if I don't speak yours?" "Oh, my friend," she laid her hand lightly on his arm, and he pleaded earnestly, "Len, why won't you tell me what's happened?" She shrugged again. "Oh's anything ever happen in heaven?" He was silent, and they walked on a few yards without exchanging a word. Finally she said, "We'll tell you, but where? One can't be alone for a minute in that great seminary of a house, with all the doors wide open, and always a servant bringing tea, or a log for the fire, or the newspaper. Is there nowhere in an American house, where one may be by oneself? You're so shy, and yet you're so public. I always feel as if I were in the convent again or on the stage, before a dreadfully polite audience that never applauds." "Ah, you don't like us," Archer exclaimed. They were walking past the house of the old patroon, with its squat walls and small square windows compactly grouped about a central chimney. The shutters stood wide, and through one of the newly washed windows Archer caught the light of a fire. "Why, the house is open," he said. She stood still. "Oh, only for today, at least. I wanted to see it, and Mr. van der Leyden had the fire lit and the windows opened, so that we might stop there on the way back from church this morning." She ran up the steps, and tried the door. "He's still unlocked, what luck. Come in and we can have a quiet talk. Mrs. van der Leyden has driven over to see her old aunts at Rinnebeck and we shan't be missed at the house for another hour." He followed her into the narrow passage. His spirits, which had dropped at her last words, rose with an irrational leap. The homely little house stood there, its panels and brasses shining in the firelight, as if magically created to receive them. A big bed of embers still gleamed in the kitchen chimney, under an iron pot hung from an ancient crane. Rush-bottomed armchairs faced each other across the tiled hearth, and rows of Delft plates stood on shelves against the walls. Archer stooped over, and threw a log upon the embers. Madame Olenska, dropping her cloak, sat down in one of the chairs. Archer leaned against the chimney and looked at her. "You're laughing now, but when you wrote me you were unhappy," he said. "Yes." She paused. "But I can't feel unhappy when you're here." "I shan't be here long," he rejoined, his lips stiffening with the effort to say, "just so much and no more." "No, I know. But I'm improvident. I live in the moment when I'm happy." The words stole through him like a temptation, and to close his senses to it, he moved away from the hearth, and stood gazing out at the black tree boles against the snow. But it was as if she too had shifted her place, and he still saw her, between himself and the trees, drooping over the fire with her indolent smile. Archer's heart was beating insubordinately. What if it were from him that as he had been running away, and if as he had waited to tell him so till they were here alone together in this secret room? "Ellen, if I'm really a help to you, if you really wanted me to come, tell me what's wrong, tell me what it is you're running away from," he insisted. He spoke without shifting his position, without even turning to look at her. If the thing was to happen, it was to happen in this way, with the whole width of the room between them, and his eyes still fixed on the outer snow. For a long moment she was silent. And in that moment Archer imagined her, almost heard her, stealing up behind him to throw her light arms about his neck. While he waited, soul and body throbbing with the miracle to come, his eyes mechanically received the image of a heavily coated man with his fur collar turned up who was advancing along the path to the house. The man was Julius Beaufort. "Ah," Archer cried, bursting into a laugh. Madame Olenska had sprung up and moved to his side, slipping her hand into his, but after a glance through the window her face paled, and she shrank back. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.